We tried to wait you out, but it apparently didn't work. And so, no, thank you for your patience.
My pleasure. All right. Good afternoon, Chairman Corbett, members of the board. My name is David Kuzmar. I am an engineer on your staff here in the planning unit. I'm here today to introduce agenda item number 7, which is an informational item featuring guest speakers from outside our organization. Before they begin their presentations, I'd like to spend just a moment to put this item into its larger context. Promoting the health and function of our region's aquatic ecosystems is a strategic priority for our organization. Key to that pursuit is finding ways to protect and restore the lands adjacent to our streams and wetlands. We call these lands riparian areas. As with any resource protection initiative, our success will be greatest if we surround ourselves with strong partners, reliable information, and science-based decision support tools. Today, we are fortunate enough to be joined by representatives from the Sonoma County Agricultural Preservation and Open Space District, as well as from the San Francisco Estuary Institute and Aquatic Science Center. Each organization has an interest in the health and function of our region's riparian areas, and each is in the process of developing sophisticated GIS tools for estimating functional riparian widths. Our staff feels these tools may hold some promise for our future assessment and planning needs. So we've invited our guests here today to introduce us to their work and to provide us with an update on their tools development efforts to date. The first to present to you here today will be Scott Dusterhoff, lead geomorphologist with the San Francisco Estuary Institute. Scott will introduce us to SFEI's new RIPSET tool and will share with us a couple of examples of how that tool might be used to help inform resource management decisions in our region. Next up will be Karen Gaffney and Tom Robinson, leaders of the Open Space District's Conservation Planning Program. They will showcase for us some of the high-resolution data and GIS tools the district has developed to help guide its purchases of conservation easements from willing landowners. At the end of these presentations, Chuck Striplin, also from SFEI, will join the rest of the panel up here to entertain any questions the board has to ask. On behalf of Matt St. John and the rest of our staff, I would like to thank each of our guest speakers for joining us here today. I will now dim the lights even further for your viewing pleasure and hand the presentation over to Scott. Thank you.
Thank you, David. Go ahead and make this comfortable for yourself. Okay. Thanks. Yeah, there's going to be a little bit of a 45-degree angle here, I think. So thank you, and thank you for having me here today. My name is Scott Dusterhoff. As David said, I am the lead geomorphologist at the San Francisco Estuary Institute Aquatic Science Center. SFEI ASC is a regional nonprofit science organization based out of Richmond, California. I think many in the room know us well. And I am here today to present some information about a planning level decision support tool that we have just released called the Riparian Zone Estimation Tool, or RIPSET for short. I'm going to start out by giving a high-level overview of riparian areas in general, why they're important, and what's been happening to riparian areas around the state over the past 150 years. Then I'll be talking about the tool that we have developed, what the tool does, the data that it needs, the data that it uses to get the output that it does, and then the types of output that it provides users. And then, as David mentioned, I'll be providing two examples of where we've run RIPSET within the North Coast region for purposes of riparian area restoration as well as riparian area protection. So to start off with, why are riparian zones important? Well, riparian zones adjacent to streams and wetlands are important because they provide a variety of very important functions. For instance, riparian vegetation is important for shading channels and helping provide cool summertime water temperatures for aquatic species. Riparian vegetation is also important for stabilizing banks and helping control fine sediment that gets into channels. Riparian vegetation is the source of wood that gets into channels that to provide habitat, as well as riparian zones provide the coarse sediment that gets into channels to provide aquatic habitat.
Riparian vegetation is important for filtering stormwater runoff from agricultural and developed lands. In low gradient alluvial channels, riparian zones are those places where floodwater gets stored and fine sediment gets trapped. And then following up on that, in these kind of low gradient channels with broad floodplains, those riparian areas are where the trapped floodwaters then ultimately infiltrate into the ground and help to recharge groundwater basins. And then also riparian areas provide a variety of, they provide habitat for a variety of animal species themselves. So they help to support aquatic habitat, but they also provide habitat themselves. So what's been happening to riparian areas around the state over the past 150 years? Well, there's been a lot of land clearing for development and agriculture, and this has decreased the size of riparian zones all around California. For instance, we know in the Central Valley since about the mid-1800s, there's been an estimated 95% loss of riparian areas. And if we look closer to home, within the Russian River watershed, since about the mid-1800s, there's been an estimated 90% loss of riparian areas, okay? So this decrease in riparian areas around the state has had considerable impacts on habitat as well as on flooding and water supply, okay? So it's affected conditions that matter to animals, but it also affects conditions that matter to people as well. So we know that there is now a considerable amount of energy going towards both protecting healthy riparian areas and restoring impacted riparian areas around the state. And over the past decade or so, managers have been moving towards this concept of variable riparian widths, okay? This idea that the riparian areas that we need to protect should not all be the same size. One size does not fit all. We know that riparian areas provide different functions, and those functions vary with channel type and where you are in the watershed, and so our protection approaches need to match that as well. And we now have high-resolution data needed to support estimating these variable widths, and Tom and Karen are going to talk a bit about some of these data, and some of the most important ones that we have now are high-resolution elevation data, or LIDAR data, okay? So we have the science that tells us we need variable widths. We have the data to help support that. So what we need now are science-based tools where we can actually enter the information and come up with appropriate riparian widths based on channel-specific information. So that brings us to RIPSET. RIPSET is one such tool that has recently been developed that can help come up with this variable riparian width. So the purpose of RIPSET is to estimate width based on function and watershed location. Okay, so let's walk through how that works. So what we have here is an idealized cross-section going from a channel to a riparian zone in the floodplain up to the upland. And we know that as you move away from the channel, the riparian functions change. So close to the channel, riparian functions are really focused on bank stability, large woody debris input, shading. As you move away from the channel, it transitions into functions more about filtering, habitat, those types of things. So we wanted to develop a tool that could actually match the appropriate width with the function of interest. We also know that riparian functions change depending on where you are in the watershed. So high up in the watershed, in these headwater regions, riparian functions really are about large woody debris input, coarse sediment input for habitat. As you move further down the watershed in this mid-watershed zone, it becomes more about bank stability, shading, filtering, those types of things. And then as you move down to the low gradient, kind of lower watershed zone where there's broad floodplains, these alluvial zones, riparian functions transition into things more about floodwater storage, groundwater recharge, those types of things. So we wanted to develop a tool that could be run in any watershed location to come up with appropriate functional width. So the overall approach for RIPSET is to use an understanding of riparian functioning with appropriate site-specific physical parameters to estimate existing and or desired riparian area extent. Okay, so this is an important point, I think, to park on for a moment. What the user can do is use RIPSET with existing conditions and say, okay, what does the site look like today? What's the functional width in 2015? Or the user can put in historical conditions or some desired restored condition and see how the riparian extent changes. Okay, so this is, you know, the user can really use this tool in either looking at existing conditions or in a gaming mode, if you will. So some important things to know about the tool. First, it's a GIS-based desktop planning tool that can be run with readily accessible data. Okay, it's meant to be run with information that the user can readily retrieve. It was developed using the best available science. regarding controls on riparian functional width. Okay, so this tool really distills and synthesizes a lot of the information that's just been coming out in the literature over the past several years. It has adaptable parameters that can be updated to reflect local conditions. Okay, so it has an out-of-the-box parameterization, so all the variables in the tool have values, and the user can run the tool with those values, or the user can very easily update those variable values based on site-specific conditions. And the tool currently uses three distinct modules to estimate functional riparian extent. Okay, so in the current version of the tool, we have three modules that are related to most of the riparian functions of interest, but not all. So this is still a work in progress, and as we move forward, our goal is to develop more modules that address other functions not currently captured within RIPSET. But for now, we have three modules that address most of the functions. I'll talk about those three modules in the following slides, but before I do, it's important to point out that the first two modules I discuss have been developed for some time now, and we've been running them in watersheds around the state of California for the past several years to come up with functional riparian width extents. The third module is really the one where we've been spending the most development time over the past 2 years, and that one is really just hot off the press. So module number one is called the hill slope module. And within this module, riparian functional width is estimated based on adjacent hill slope gradient. And this module is really meant for steep headwater channels. And the targeted functions, targeted function is a coarse sediment input. So what we see here is a field site where running the hill slope module would be appropriate, steep adjacent hill slope gradient, and just a little schematic showing, essentially the major variables. This functional width is based on this adjacent hill slope angle. The quick story is as this angle gets larger, this functional width increases. The next module is called the vegetation module, and it comes up with an estimate of functional riparian width based on adjacent hill slope gradient, again, but also vegetation height. And this module can really be applied throughout a watershed within steep headwater reaches all the way down to low gradient alluvial reaches. And the targeted functions for this module really are the things that we usually think about when we think about riparian areas, large weighted debris input, shading, bank stabilization, runoff filtration. And again, on the right here, we have a simple schematic illustrating the variables used to come up with the width within the module. And the quick story here is, although bank angle and vegetation height are both kind of key players, it's this vegetation height that really drives it. So you can kind of think of it simply as the larger the vegetation on in the riparian zone, the greater the functional width estimate. And then the third module, as I mentioned earlier, the one that's just hot off the press, is called the hydrologic connectivity module, or HICON module for short. This module estimates riparian functional width based on flooding extent. And this module is really geared towards, low gradient alluvial channels far down in the watershed, those channels with broad floodplains, either existing broad floodplains or historical broad floodplains. And the targeted functions are floodwater storage and groundwater recharge. So what I show here on the right is a kind of a simple channel cross-section. So the concept here is the larger the flooding extent, the greater the riparian width estimate. The floods that we are focused on in this module to date are the 10 and 50 year floods. The literature tells us that in this part of California, those are the historical floods that are most important in controlling the width of the riparian zone. So the idea again is the larger the flooding extent for those two floods, the greater the functional width estimate within this module. So that's a quick snapshot of the riparian zone estimation tool, the modules that the tool uses to come up with a functional width estimate. So what I want to do now is walk through two examples of where we used the tool within the North Coast region. And the first place is in the Santa Rosa Plain. So application number one here is using RIPSET for riparian restoration planning. And what I'm going to show you is the output of looking at existing functional riparian widths for what we're considering here to be an impacted watershed. Okay. So what we see here is a map of the Santa Rosa Plain, the watershed boundary outlined in red, and the green is the vegetation module output for this area. Okay. So I think maybe the first thing that you see off the bat is, man, there's a lot of white in here and there's not much green. And that's important. That's an important fact. The idea here is there's not much functional riparian width left in the Santa Rosa Plain because of all the clearing that's happened over the past 150 years. And if I put on the channel and watershed layer, that becomes even more obvious. So you see the channel network here now in blue. Historically, you would have seen green adjacent to these channels. There would have been functional riparian width, but today there is very little or none. So a highly impacted watershed. So what we did to determine how impacted is we started to look at the riparian widths in width classes. Okay, so this is how that turned out. So what we see here on the y-axis is riparian width classes, okay, going from very little width, about a meter, all the way up to greater than 100, and looking at the total length of channels that we ran the tool for within the Santa Rosa Plain. Okay, we looked at natural and unnatural channels, but for all intents and purposes, just look at the total bar length here. So let me walk you through this plot. So up here, towards the top of the y-axis, these width classes, okay, you know, the widths greater than 40 meters, these are the fully functional widths, okay? This is within this this width of riparian, you have a maximum number of riparian functions met, including habitat, okay? And that's important because habitat is really important because different animals need different widths. And so if we are saying that, man, 100 meters, 300 feet wide, you're getting most of the functions of riparian areas, including habitat, you have a very functional riparian area. So that's what the categories towards the top, fully functional. Conversely, towards the bottom of the y-axis, these width classes, 1 meter to 5 meter wide, okay, a small number of riparian functions are within these areas, and we're calling them minimally functional, okay? So then how does this all play out? Well, within the Santa Rosa Plain, according to the vegetation module, almost none of the channels have a fully functional riparian zone. There's not many channels that fall within these top two categories, less than 5% of the channels out there. About 15% of the channels in the Santa Rosa Plain fall within this moderately functional, within these moderately functional width classes, okay? And then the majority of channels in the Santa Rosa Plain today fall into this minimally functional class, okay? Nearly 85% of the channels fall within this minimally functional class. So this is important information to know how affected the watershed is, and this can be a good first step to start to think about restoration priorities and restoration actions. So application number two is in the Eel River watershed, and this was geared more towards riparian area protection. We ran RIPSET within the Eel River watershed, working with staff to get an estimate on what functional width was within an unimpacted watershed to get a sense on how wide kind of setback should be to protect beneficial uses. Okay, so what we're going to be looking at here is existing functional riparian widths for what we're considering an unimpacted watershed, or two unimpacted watersheds, actually. So here we are, Humboldt County, Eel River. We ran the vegetation and hill slope modules for two catchments, Grizzly Creek and Sproul Creek. And here's what the results look like. So Grizzly Creek, a map of the channel network, and then the output for the vegetation and hill slope modules, shown in green for vegetation, brown for hill slope. So if we zoom in on just one area, you can get a better look. You see the hill slope module output here, not that wide, really just, and the idea or the reason behind that is because the adjacent hill slope angles are not that steep. So therefore, the hill slope module did not really kick in. And then most of the functional width that's mapped here comes from the vegetation module. So that's what the output looks like for Grizzly Creek. Sproul Creek, similar situation. Again, not much brown, not much hill slope output because the adjacent hill slope angle's not that steep. Most of what we see here is from the vegetation module. So then we did the same thing with these widths we did with the Santa Rosa Plain. We said, okay, let's group them into classes and see how that looks. Again, we have riparian width classes here on the y-axis. And it's a different story here, okay? So for the unimpacted watershed, for current conditions, most of the channels fell into this fully functional category, okay? So you have very wide functional widths in Sproul Creek and Grizzly Creek. So this is some important information that can be used to then think about, okay, well, what's the appropriate setback width if we want to be protecting these areas and supporting the functions that are there now and that were there historically. So a high-level overview of using RIPSET for two different applications. So in terms of the products and what one gets with RIPSET, RIPSET has now been released to the public. It was released in April 2015. So users can now go to the project website and download the tool and some other useful information. So the user can get the tool itself, which is a combination of a GIS ARC tool, okay, as well as an Excel macro, an Excel spreadsheet. The user can also get a very detailed user manual that walks the user through using the tool from turning it on and starting up the program to getting data to running the tool to working with the output to troubleshooting. The user can also get some information about the science behind RIPSET, okay, the literature values that we use to actually build the modules. And then there's some other supporting module development documentation in there as well. This is the website address, and I encourage anyone interested to actually go to the website and download the tool and use it at your leisure. And then there's some next steps that we're planning on. So I mentioned that RIPSET is developed. It's out there to the world for the world to use. But we want to continue developing it, okay? Like any tool, it can only be improved as we keep working on it. And so one of the first things we want to do is keep developing the existing modules. And that includes things like additional validation, okay? We collected a lot of data to build these modules, but they can only be stronger with more data from different places around the state. So that's one thing we want to do. Another thing is develop that hydrologic connectivity module, that third module, to be appropriate for large watershed areas. So currently, it's a very reach-specific process that the module uses to come up with functional width based on flooding extent. We want to modify that and come up with a way to actually make it be run watershed-wide to get, if the user wants fine scale information, they can do that for a reach. If they want coarser scale watershed-wide information, they can do that too. So that's on our plate for next steps. And then, as I mentioned earlier, we want to develop additional modules. The three modules we have cover many of the functions, but they do not cover them all. So we've been talking with several partners, including folks on staff with the North Coast Regional Board, as well as the State Water Resources Control Board and other partners at NOAA and U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service to come up with some ideas for the next phase of module development. And three module ideas really have risen to the top. The first is coming up with a module that can help determine the degree of channel incision. Okay, so this is important not only from a channel stability point of view, but this also can help us understand how much groundwater storage potential we have lost over time. So the quick idea is the more incised the channel is, the lower the adjacent groundwater table, so the less groundwater storage you have. And so if we can come up with an idea on how incised our channels are, at least with a given watershed of interest, you can really come up with an idea on how much groundwater storage potential you've lost, and that can help guide restoration priorities. The next is stream shading. I know that that's really important to you all, and so that's something that we've been talking with staff here about developing a stream shading module. And then the third is this habitat module, okay? This is essentially, can be considered the holy grail of module development because coming up with a module for habitat that meets the habitat needs of all of the animals that we know use the riparian zone for either part or all of their lives is very complex. So developing this module would be quite an effort. So, high-level overview of what's coming next for RIPSET, and so I am happy to take any questions that you have.
Okay, board members.
Yeah, thank you, Scott. I really appreciate the effort and the work. Excuse me. Just a quick question, because I think it relates back to the definition of what is habitat. In the Russian River example, you said highly functional. You defined highly functional width as up to 100 meters. And then in the Eel River, you used that same definition but only went out 60 meters. Why?
Why? That's a great question. I guess the first thing maybe to clarify is you're totally right that the y-axis on those two plots was not exactly the same. But if and I can actually go back. Sorry, let me quickly spin back to the Santa Rosa Plain one first. So I guess one of the main points to take away here is riparian widths greater than 40, okay, 40 to 99, greater than 100, these two classes, we're saying, for all intents and purposes, mean it's fully functional. So maybe you can think of it more as, if it's greater than 40 meters, it falls into the fully functional riparian zone category. And so then with that in mind, when we get to Sproul and Grizzly, it's, you know, greater than 60, kind of that, essentially the same, you know, the same width, that's your fully functional. So it's kind of greater than 40 or so brings you into the fully functional realm.
With the explanation, it makes sense. So I appreciate that. And the reason I raise it is because, you know, you start getting into functional riparian habitat and you start talking about edge effects and interior species versus edge species and whether we're talking about, I liked your picture of your yellow-billed cuckoo up there. I wish they were on the Russian River. They used to be. But again, it's just, you know, words matter.
Yes.
And as you're rolling this thing out, I think the more you can standardize your imagery and,
yes,
and how you message it, will just add strength to what is a very powerful story. That's all. So I'm on your side on this.
Thank you. I appreciate the feedback.
Mr. Chair?
Yes.
Scott, thanks. Great tool, by the way. Can you give some type of indication? So how much field assessment or how much assessment, like on Sproul Creek, how many hours or how many days was somebody out there plotting around out there? Is this field work? Is this LIDAR? Is this aerial photos? What is this?
That's a great question. So what this is all a desktop analysis at this point. So what we did is we started with our tool in GIS let's back up one slide here. So we opened up GIS, we said RIPSET start, and we brought in two pieces of information. We brought in topography, so whatever the best topography was here, it was not LIDAR, it was, I believe it was 10 meter.
DEM map or something.
So it was topography, we brought that in, and then we brought in the best available vegetation data that we had, and we brought that information in, and we said RIPSET, do your thing, and it went through its computations, and then it kicked out these maps. And so this is very planning level, very just, here's a quick snapshot of what the functional width is. And so then in terms of the field kind of component of this, what then we could do is take this information and go out to the field and say, okay, well, does this match what we're seeing in the field? And what I think we really would be doing is field validating the vegetation data that we use, because that vegetation data is really driving the vegetation module output, which is the dominant output you see here on this map. And so that would be a next step to see how good the input data are. And we know that the output's only going to be as good as the input.
Yeah, I had a really interesting experience a couple of years ago where we got into both the Shasta TMDL renewal. There's a waiver on the Shasta and the Scott, actually. And site potential shade kind of came at those same times for me, right? And we had this whole discussion about site potential shade. And I went and did a tour of the Shasta one day, and the, one of the fellows I was with, we went to, and there's been a tremendous amount of work in those watersheds, RCDs, landowners, NGOs, agencies, everybody's been out there, and still going, doing great stuff. And we stopped at this one guy's place, and he said, I planted, we had a project here 18 years ago, I think, and we planted this whole thing with willows and a variety of riparian vegetation, and he said, this is kind of what we got, right? Mm-hmm. And is this site potential shade? And granted, they're on the Shasta Plain, basically, which is a high desert plateau. It probably gets less than 15 inches of rain annually.
Right.
It's not a closed canopy system with big conifers or anything like that. But it was quite interesting to me. It's like, I think if this is what you got, then this is what you're going to get. I mean, they had it fenced. They had water. They had species. They probably had gophers, beavers, and everybody else eating
right.
on them. But the thing is, it's very interesting that the outcome, while the intent was to probably fully vegetate and maybe even close that canopy,
mm-hmm.
the outcome in reality was much different than
right.
that. And so I think it's quite interesting, and it's absolutely crucial to have tools where you could dream it and then kind of see what you get. I'm also interested in the Santa Rosa Plain. I do a lot of work on the Santa Rosa Plain as a consultant, and I'm always curious to look at the aerial photo sets that we can get and buy off the shelf starting 1942,
right.
and you know, pretty intact for the most part, riparian across the Santa Rosa Plain in 42, 52, kind of the same, a little less, 61, a lot of it's gone. 71, it's absolutely gone,
mm-hmm.
And you see straight line channels, and they were made trapezoidal, and they're hardened, and those exist in some form today. And so the challenges I see in the Santa Rosa Plain is, okay, well, you're hemmed by width often because they've been encroached upon heavily. You've got a lot of variables there. And these tools, I think this is a cool tool. I think this is great to have. The challenges is then the ground truthing. So, you know, you get out there and you found, is this site potential shade? Well, I think it is.
Right.
Maybe. How do you make that better? I mean, I think these tools are crucial.
And kind of along those lines, it feels like for that Santa Rosa Plain, for the next level of planning, so you have what the vegetation module gives you of what's there. If you put in, like you're saying, the vegetation that existed in the 1950s, you could say what it could be if you brought that back. And then you can bring on, you know, other constraints like, okay, well, where is there now development? Where is there places that we can't do anything? And that actually starts to sharpen the picture a bit and let you know where your opportunities really are, as opposed to kind of getting you pie in the sky and then kind of bringing you down to earth.
Well, there's also that kind of that variable. It's like, what does it want to be? Mm-hmm. We had a project a while back where we planted willows. And the willows, you know, you basically just chop a piece of willow at the right time of year and put it in the ground. And by God, that thing actually goes for it. And it's pretty amazing. And
yes.
And it's like, if you give it that chance and you're not mowing on it or grazing on it or pushing on it or encroaching upon it, it can do stuff, you know. It's kind of what you want and what you can do with the palette of options that you potentially have there. Great tool.
Great, thank you.
Exciting.
Board Member Massey.
Scott, for those of us that are not scientists by occupation, walk me through, they drop you off in the middle of Europe someplace and say, give us an estimate on this. Walk me through just the basic process of how you would do this.
In Europe?
Oh, well. I don't mean go to Italy and have fun. That's not what I'm saying. No, I mean,
sure.
Just in terms of it's a yes. GIS, obviously, that's satellite.
Yes.
But how, you know, where do we start? Where do we end?
Right, okay. So, good question. So, I guess the idea is that, let's say, start at the beginning, you go to the website and you say, hey, I want the tool, and you download the tool. So, what the tool is, as I mentioned, it's two things. It's essentially a program that you can run in GIS, which is a mapping software. So it's something that you bring into the mapping software, and it's also a second piece, which I will just drop off now. So we stick with that piece of software that you bring into the mapping software. So you open up your mapping software on your computer. You bring in that little program that you just downloaded off of our website. And so the program asks you for things. It says, okay, where is your site of interest? And so you can give it coordinates. You can say, here's the lat, here's the long, boom. Or you can give it a watershed. You can say, I'm in Sproul Creek, and you give it a watershed boundary, another piece of mapping mapping information. So you let it know where you are. And I'll just talk about the vegetation and hill slope modules, because they are siblings, and they're easy to talk about together. So the next thing that this mapping software wants is to know what the stream channel network looks like. Okay, so basically, if you're looking on a USGS topographic map and you see all the blue lines, the software wants to know what those blue lines look like. And so you can bring that information in. So now in your mapping software, you know where you are, and you have the channel network. And so then the third thing that the tool asks you for is vegetation information. What's the vegetation look like? Do you have, is it all grasslands? Do you have conifers next to channels? What's it look like? And there's different websites you can go to download vegetation information. Some of it is very coarse, some of it is finer scale, but it's up to the user to put in the data that he or she has at hand. So you've got the tool open, the mapping software, you've got your location on in Europe, you've got your channel network, you've got your watershed boundary, you've got your vegetation information, and then the last thing it wants is topography. So, you know, what's the topography look like? It would be best if you had LIDAR, which is very, very fine scale topography. That's not always available, so there's coarser scale stuff that the USGS puts out that you can use that'll work. And so you put your topography in. So you've got all your pieces in there. The tool says, okay, I'm happy. You've given me everything I need. I can do my job. So you say, please do your job, and you hit run. The tool does its thing for anywhere from 5 to 10 minutes. It actually provides on screen information about what's happening. It says, okay, I've loaded this. Okay, that's running fine. I've loaded this. That's running fine. If things are wrong, it will tell you what is wrong, and it will stop and say, hey, user, you need to do X, Y, or Z before we keep going. But let's say everything goes right. The tool does its thing. And then what it gives you, the first thing it gives you is a map with this type of information. So over top of the channel network that you gave it, it puts out the hill slope polygons, the hill slope kind of areas, and the vegetation areas. And it says, based on the information you gave me, user, this is what the functional riparian width looks like. And then the next thing it does, it says, hey, do you want me to organize these data in any special way? And you say, yes. And then it kicks out this type of plot. So there's different things you can, so you can get a map. That's the first thing you can do. And then the tool asks you if you want to see the information in different ways. If you say yes, one of the things it gives you is information in a graphical form like this.
Cool.
So I guess maybe I'll finish it by saying one of the things that that is kind of presupposed when running this tool is that, you know, the user really does have to know GIS fairly well. The user has to know where to get the data that he or she needs. And then I didn't mention this at all, and I won't in any real way, but the user also does have to know how to use Excel, the spreadsheet software, to do some things. So it's not necessarily meant for any user. It is meant, you know, I guess what we say in the manual, for a somewhat savvy GIS user. That's really the intended audience.
So maybe for a guy with a flip phone, this is not for you?
I think it could be for you. I think it could be for you. I think if you read the user manual,
it's
a few
It's for Mr. Kuznar.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah. We get to ask the questions. He gets to get the answers. No, that's the understanding.
Was that helpful?
It is. I understand the concept of adding things to an already GIS-based tool.
Gotcha. And it is rather quick. And actually, as time goes on, and I mentioned this earlier, the development of this tool continues. It is only getting faster and faster. We are now, every week, we figure out a new way that we can turn a knob inside the tool and make it run 2 minutes faster. So this thing is getting faster and faster as time goes on.
Well, I think for our staff, particularly where human beings tend to rotate through, it is the sort of stuff that rapidly changes the ability of a staff to understand a particular watershed.
Yes.
I mean, you don't have to actually go out and look at it. That doesn't hurt it, but this, I understand what that does. Thank you.
Yeah, my pleasure.
Mr. Chair?
Valerie.
Thank you.
Board Member Minson.
Thank you. Thank you for the presentation. It's really, really interesting stuff. Early on, you mentioned that this is all based on the variable riparian widths concept. One size does not fit all. And then as you went through the watershed examples, you had sort of the category of greater than 40 meters or greater than 60 meters as a fully functional width. Am I understanding correctly that when you run this tool in different watersheds or even within portions of those watersheds, you might have areas where the fully functional riparian width that was desirable might be only 30 meters or might be a minimum of 70 meters, that the tool is not necessary, there's not one set value that you're looking for as fully functional. It's really based on the different scenario.
Yes, and I think that, and what I show here, this is a good example, for, you know, Sproul Creek and Grizzly Creek, is a simplified example, okay? So I guess the one thing I'll say is the channel network that we're showing here is not the full channel network, right? There's a bunch of smaller, lower order channels that are coming off these hill slopes. And then the idea is that for those smaller channels coming off these hill slopes that we don't represent here because it was just, you know, the way that we did the analysis that we did, those would have narrow widths, right? Those would be the areas where you would run the hill slope module, and you would expect those areas to be where coarse sediment is coming in. So if those areas are very steep, they are giving coarse sediment to the channel, but there's not a lot of riparian vegetation there naturally, then those would just by their very nature have a somewhat narrower riparian width. The flip side of that, this is just hill slope and vegetation. I did not run the hydrologic connectivity module here, but if we were to run the hydrologic connectivity module in one of these kind of lower gradient reaches towards the watershed mouth, and again, these are quote-unquote unimpacted channels, so they're not incised, you would think the 50-year flood extent would be very wide. So it would be much wider than the green that you see here. Okay, so this is what comes back to, you know, the width is dependent on the functions that you care about. For vegetation, you know, for all the green you see here, the functions that that module is targeting is large wood, shading, filtering, stability. But, and so that's the width that you get with those functions. But if you were looking at coarse sediment, which hill slope does, you know, we've got much smaller widths if you're thinking about just coarse sediment. Or if you're thinking about flooding, you'd have much larger widths if you're thinking about flooding. That's how it would play out in a map like this.
So then up at the, like at the very top of that watershed, that width of that green band might not actually be applicable to that setting? Up in the upper watershed, that might not be the function that you were looking for?
Well, I guess the idea is that since this watershed, and it might be helpful if I had the vegetation map here, but I think the concept here is that this watershed is very well vegetated with large trees, and it has been that way, and it's that way now, and it was that way historically. So that's why you're getting these wide functional widths with the vegetation module. If you were in a different type of watershed where naturally, okay, if we were calling it unimpacted and it was all grasslands here up at the headwaters, then this green would be much, much narrower. Okay, so it really is a function of the vegetation, at least the green here, is a function of the vegetation that you have. And so if the natural vegetation for an unimpacted watershed is grasslands, this green would be very narrow. But since the unimpacted vegetation here is large conifers, even up here at the headwaters, your functional width is very wide because that vegetation is driving that functional width.
I guess what I'm wondering is if part of what this model tells you, does this tell you if there are cases where the riparian vegetation is narrower than you might think you want, and the model's able to tell you, well, in this area, that's okay? Like to inform decisions about what areas, in which areas it's really worth trying to expand the riparian corridor versus areas where that effort may not be worth it because a narrow area is providing the appropriate functions for that portion of the watershed.
I see. So maybe your question is, let me see if I understand the question. Is it, if you were to lay this information over the actual vegetation map, mm-hmm. you can actually see some areas you're going to say vegetation is much wider than the functional width, so you're actually doing okay. You've actually got the functional width you need, so low priority. Other areas where the vegetation is actually much narrower than this functional width, you're saying, hey, those are the areas that you really need to target. Is that kind of, does that get to?
Yeah, that was kind of what I was looking for. Thank you.
Okay, sure.
Any further board member questions? Okay. Thank you for your presentation.
My pleasure. Thank you.
Oh, okay. Great. Thank you. Good afternoon, everyone. Okay. Stand by, please. Oh, there we go. Good afternoon. I'm Karen Gaffney with the Sonoma County Agricultural Preservation and Open Space District, and I'm joined by Tom Robinson, my colleague in the Conservation Planning Program. And we are a local conservation district that primarily works through voluntary incentive-based conservation, so we're non-regulatory. So we're going to talk about some tools and data that we are developing to support our conservation investments in Sonoma County. So just a little background. I'm going to give more of the context slides, and then Tom's going to talk about some of the modeling that we've been doing. As many of you know, Sonoma County Ag Preservation and Open Space District was envisioned by the voters of Sonoma County, and it reflects their vision and their public trust goals, and it was founded in 1990 and reauthorized in 2006 with approximately 76% of the vote. And we're funded by a quarter-cent sales tax, which we leverage very heavily with outside funding. We have a very diverse mission. It's multi-objective, as the name implies, focusing on agriculture and open space, but also biodiversity, water quality and supply, recreation. We've been doing a lot of work evaluating our impact on the local economy and public health. And to date, we've protected approximately 106,000 acres, predominantly through conservation easements, which we're going to drill down on in a little more detail, but also through some fee purchases, primarily for recreation. And our organizational focus is to use science in an adaptive way to drive and refine our actions over time. So we use a very strong adaptive management approach, and you'll hear about some of the scientific data that we're using to drive that approach today, specific to riparian corridor conservation. And our spatial scale at the district is anywhere from the entire landscape of Sonoma County, and in some cases beyond, down to the project site scale. And our temporal scale, because we're authorized to work in perpetuity, we like to call now to forever. And so that has bearing on what we're going to talk about in terms of riparian easements. So we have been doing a lot of thinking in recent years about how to protect the riparian corridors that Scott was talking about that have been so impacted through a voluntary incentive-based approach of working with private landowners and willing sellers. And so to do that, we need to understand not only the regulatory framework, and it's one of the reasons we were very interested in coming to talk to you about how can we complement your work since we're non-regulatory. And we also need to understand from a science-based perspective what is the width that these corridors need to have in order to be functional over the long term. So moving beyond buffers and setbacks into that kind of multi-width dimension that Scott was referring to. And so we think a lot about the space-time continuum, as it were. So in terms of space, we think a lot about the meander corridors. You know, we live in a system here in the Russian, for example, that is very volatile, and especially with atmospheric rivers predicted to become more and more frequent, some of the great work the Water Agency is doing on that topic. We're expecting to see some big storms kind of all at once, and that will even drive some of the movement of these meander corridors even faster and harder. So the top left picture is Alexander Valley, and that system has moved back and forth across its floodplain just in the last 10 years, you know, well over half a mile. The bottom photo is a documentation of the low flow channel over a 150-year period that was done by Elder and Laird. And what it shows, that's the middle reach between Healdsburg and Wooler Bridge. And it shows that the low flow channel moved back and forth across the floodplain well over a mile in about a 20-year period. So very, very volatile systems, and we need to understand their kind of long-term trajectories in order to protect them. And then on the right-hand side, there's the old joke that I think several people have made, but Matt Condolf makes it about river systems, which they are long periods of boredom punctuated by brief moments of terror. So the top picture, the bucolic Russian River in the summertime, which we canoe on, and the bottom picture, Guerneville under 27 feet of water in 1986. And so we really need to understand the extent of the floodplain and this meander corridor in order to think about how to protect these systems in perpetuity. So the key questions that are driving our work around riparian corridor conservation are both science-based and policy-based. So as I alluded to, how wide do we need to protect these corridors in order for them to have long-term function? How wide do we need to negotiate our easements? We need to understand the multiple benefits and values of functional corridors, so not just focusing on kind of the really totemic species, as it were, like salmonids, but also yellow-billed cuckoo. How can we bring them back? They've been extirpated in the Russian, but we did have them here as recently maybe as the 50s. And we also need to understand what are the data needs that we have in order to make us as accurate as possible in determining this functional width so we can use it as the basis to have a negotiation with a private landowner about these easements. And then also, how do we use these data to support engagement of the public so that they understand why the district, which is their quarter cent funded sales tax district, is investing in riparian corridor conservation so that they feel confident that we're using the most credible science-based data to do that work. And then, of course, from a policy-based perspective, it's very important to us to understand where does the regulatory boundary that separates voluntary incentive-based conservation from regulated riparian corridors, where does that exist? So the work that you all are doing in considering regulatory issues, as well as the work that, say, PRMD has recently done in developing their recent ordinance, is very helpful to us because we cannot pay landowners to for a conservation easement to protect something that's already required by law to be protected. So our work actually starts outside of that regulatory boundary. And then we're very interested in exploring kind of new tools besides the traditional conservation easement for that incentive side of the equation where we work. And so I'll talk about those in just a moment. typically, we as a district have tended to put easements over entire properties. So for example, Cooley Ranch, we extinguished about 65 development rights above Lake Sonoma so that now there's just agriculture and natural areas up there, and that protects the water quality and water supply coming into Lake Sonoma. So that's an example of a very large 18,000-acre whole property easement in the upper part of the recharge landscape. But with riparian corridors, we are starting to consider maybe spatially explicit riparian corridor easements where if land is protected in ag already, say in the Laguna, and that landowner is interested, for example, in just having a targeted riparian corridor easement that might expand that corridor out to a functional width, but they don't necessarily want to put the easement over the whole property, we're very interested in understanding that alluvial width. And so here's an example of what a riparian easement could look like. Of course, there could be all over the map, so to speak, but the way we work with our conservation easements is we work with a private landowner as a partner, and it's a negotiation, and most of our easements satisfy multiple objectives and interests, so we want to understand how can we expand the riparian corridor for biodiversity reasons, but also maybe avoid flood damage for the landowner, still have them have access to riparian water rights, maybe minimize Pierce's disease, invasive species, et cetera. So there are unlimited configurations. Our easements can be just a portion of the property, or we can write into a full property easement that the riparian corridor needs to be protected, or a particular forest area, or some other natural area. And more we're leaning towards using some affirmative tools, which might, you know, historically we've basically said, you just need to stay what's called a prohibited use, stay out of the riparian corridor and have your ag practice here and your house here, and that's fine. But more and more we're starting to look at affirmative tools which say, in addition to staying out of the riparian corridor, we also would negotiate with the landowner that they would actually keep it free of invasive species and possibly do habitat restoration potentially with an RCD. And the affirmative easements can also require more active management. So with that, I'm going to context setting, I'm going to turn it over to my colleague Tom Robinson to talk about some of the scientific data and tools that we're using to support these transactions.
Great. Thank you very much, Karen. Tom Robinson, conservation planner with the Sonoma County Agricultural Preservation and Open Space District. I'm very pleased to be sharing this afternoon with you all this this tool that we've been working on. We don't have a neat name like RIPZET. But it has a very similar purpose as RIPZET. What makes the model work is LIDAR, and I'll touch on LIDAR in just a moment. But before I do that, I wanted to just toot the horn of a program that we have in Sonoma County called the Sonoma County Vegetation Mapping and LIDAR Program, and this is a consortium of local, state, federal, and NGO organizations that have pooled their resources to acquire a suite of fine-scale environmental data for Sonoma County. That includes fine-scale vegetation and land cover, the LIDAR data that I'll be touching on in just a moment, for which we received a $1 million grant from NASA, agriculture and cropland mapping, pervious and impervious surfaces, and aerial photography. And you can learn more about this really neat consortium program at sonomavegmap.org. And you can also download LIDAR data, one-foot contours, a whole suite of fine-scale environmental data. And we're just very proud of this program. And there are several representatives in the audience today from our partner organizations. I just wanted to turn your attention to these partners here. So LIDAR stands for Light Detection and Ranging. It's a foundational data set for the veg map, impervious surfaces, and agricultural mapping, and so many other layers, but very important to riparian modeling, as Scott was mentioning. But essentially what it is it's sounding light against surfaces to map a cloud of points that gives you, once you stitch those together, gives you a really accurate model of the terrain. And I just wanted to point out that this is a side-by-side comparison of a digital elevation model using existing 10-meter DEM data from the USGS, and this is a LIDAR-derived hillshade, just to give you a visceral sort of look at LIDAR. To illustrate this a little bit more, LIDAR gives you vegetation height, it gives you canopy density, and it also gives you really fine scale. Oh, come back, you. Well, let's move on. What I wanted to show was this this bare earth digital elevation model. What you can do with LIDAR is peel off all of the vegetation and buildings and anything that's on the earth, and it gives you a very clear look at the bare earth. And so we wanted to put this in to show you, to kind of root the LIDAR and what it can show within the context of what Karen was talking about, where we might work with a landowner. So in this image, you can see sort of the former fluvial landscape there. And there's been some berming to accommodate and create some space for this vineyard here. And so our question is, if we were to work with this landowner to maybe remove or move that berm, what could the river do to heal itself, and how can our conservation easement tool facilitate that process? We wanted to illustrate the benefit of this new tool by comparing it to our existing practices. What we do right now is we digitize existing vegetation from aerial photos around a stream, and I chose this photo in particular. This is from 1993 because something happened between 1993 and when this photo was taken in 2004. The stream decided to take a hard left turn about 100 meters to the east, and if we had worked with a landowner to conserve that riparian zone that was based solely on vegetation or an existing stream center line, our conservation easement would completely miss the new main channel of this stream. And this is just a really great example. You know, if we were to use buffering and other methods like that, it would also have the same result. And this is, you know, a typical width for, county zoning in various areas. And so this presents a problem. We want to devise an area to work with willing sellers within that accommodates these types of shifts, very natural shifts that happen in alluvial floodplains. So that's where LIDAR comes in. LIDAR is, again, it's a high-resolution model of the ground. We have a 1-meter DEM from LIDAR in Sonoma County now because of the Sonoma County Vegetation Mapping and LIDAR Program. It's a very accurate depiction of the floodplain. You can see this LIDAR-derived cross-section. It's excellent for terrain mapping. And because we have this data, we now can move on to the next level, which is finding an equation to relate the terrain to the functional riparian zone. Here, I'm going to move this to the side so I'm not popping this thing. That's where regional curves of hydraulic geometry come in. These are equations that correlate bankfull depth and width to drainage area. And bankfull depth is depicted on this profile map as the distance between the lowest part of the stream and the top of the bank. Now, Collins and Leventhal in 2013 published these equations for Marin and Sonoma County using field data that correlate drainage area to bank full depth or vice versa. Now, drainage area is something we can easily calculate using a GIS. It's a very simple thing to do. And so what we're interested in doing is using methods that have been developed by, in particular, Benda and others in 2011, who showed in the Pacific Northwest that the width at three times bank full is the future potential meander landscape. Now, that's fascinating to us because if we can work with these two elements, the hydraulic curve equation and then also the LIDAR, we might be able to map the future potential meander landscape. So that's our question. So let's take a look at how we're putting all these things together. We have our regional curve from Collins and Leventhal. and we have our 1 meter DEM. And now we can ask the DEM, show us the width at one times bankful. And that's in the dark green in the upper right-hand corner, and it's also shown in the cross-section. Then we ask, what's two times bankful? What's three times bankful? And so we can literally plot these out on the landscape. So let's look at what this output looks like on the ground. This is a confluence of Marquess Creek and Porter Creek on a property that the district owns. And so we can go out and sort of test the efficacy of this model. And what we found is wetland species quite a distance away from the active channel, which makes us think that maybe this is part of the, or it at least indicates that it's part of the riparian zone, possibly fed through a riparian aquifer. So this is very exciting for us, and we found that four times bankful is getting us the results that we would like. So let's go back to that scenario where our tool, our existing methods might have failed us because of the natural processes of fluvial dynamics. We ran the model for this spot, and this would be the area that we would probably work with the landowner to protect now. And you can see it accommodates that shift in the stream center line. So in conclusion, we think this is an efficient method to produce high quality estimates of the riparian zone in a variety of watershed settings, but in particular that middle zone that Karen showed. Our next steps for this coming summer to field verify our results in a variety of watersheds, to test the performance in unstable streams, and investigate as Scott was mentioning, you know, how does this tool work in incised or graded systems, in unstable systems? And we as well are interested in collaborating with SFEI and others on a model coefficient that would allow the model to work as well as it is in stable streams to work in unstable streams. Further, we'd like to test the performance of this model using lower resolution terrain data, so maybe 5 or 10 meter, which would increase the applicability of this model to areas that lack LIDAR. And with that, I'd just like to thank you on behalf of Karen and myself, and we would be happy to answer any questions.
Board members?
Mr. Chair? I think between all you guys got all the cool tools, that's for darn sure. For one thing, I got to say, I really, really appreciate the work collaboratively, you know, with your partnerships with SCFI. You guys have stepped into this arena, it seems to me, relatively recently, while the district's been around for quite a long time. The pairing of the interests and the abilities here just makes great sense. And having that for, if you add an equation of water quality into that and riparian function and all the other attendant benefits that come out of that, it just makes great sense. I've been lucky enough to work on some of your projects, including the Porter Creek projects. Some of those properties up there are just fabulous. I hadn't really seen a closed canopy oak woodland like that, like on some of that upper reach in there. That's really, really cool. And that's got to be coho habitat up there straight up. Really neat tools. I think it's also interesting. I happen to live, my wife and I and our kids live on the kind of the southern end of the Laguna, out on the Laguna Plain. And in reality, I've always looked at that as a potential palette from which to play, and look at that as the connectivity of how do we as a society connect together things and make them functionally better and make them into more resilient landscapes that could then serve multiple functions, including the use of man, because frankly, that's what a lot of that is out there. I'm aware of the fact that in some of these areas, say like the city of Santa Rosa land, I'm kind of talking centric to Sebastopol, you know, city of Santa Rosa has Kelly Track down there, or the Kelly Farm and some of that. Coming south, you know, there's a fish and game property. I was actually talking to my neighbor the other day who has an organic farm out there, and I told him, I said, hey, you ought to get a conservation easement out here. And he said, what are you talking about? And I said, you got to go talk to open space, man. Because, you know, the opportunity here, it can't all be on the open space and a sales tax to go out here and buy up the world or a conservation easement to make that happen. But the opportunity is the synergy that comes from the relationships and the work of others to make it just that much better. And
we are absolutely lucky as an agency to have all you and your partners as they are now, and your future partners as people that are working in a common interest, I think, that is quite a big interest. And for that, I really thank you. I think it's quite exciting, and I think it's interesting. We have interesting decisions to make in the future about where we want to go. What are we going to do with some of this? Because, again, I referred to the center as a plane previous. And if we look at it through just my own selfish eyes and looking at the possibilities for TMDL, how do you recover the Laguna Plain to TMDL? Dave Kuzmar is a dreamer for sure, because maybe a year ago he came in here and was, you know, talking about building currency and value into projects and how do we find willing sellers and willing buyers. You know, in my scheming mind, I think, wow, that this just feeds right into this. This offers the palette of opportunity and dream from which we could then possibly do things. And it's fabulous. I think it's just fabulous. I just want to thank you very much for coming and talking to us, and please come back.
Any other board member comments or questions? Well, I just want to thank you. One, we as a board have to start warping our minds and our staff to around the advances in technology, and I think the combinations you folks are playing with are the future, and then our job is to figure out how to get the most from it. But it's a great project, and we really filled us full of ideas. So. All right. Thank you.
Thank you.